From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, do the noises from MRI machines frighten you? Well, it turns out you're not alone.
Particularly the patients who are coming from a headache, migraine standpoint, you know, introducing them into an environment that is a fairly loud on and off banging noise is counterproductive to getting a quality scan.
This American Life's Ira Glass talks about his stage show, which mixes radio with modern dance. And 11 photographers work independently and together to capture the essence of Wisconsin.
We're all making independent work, but we are kind of all, it's a bit like a band in a kind of funny way. And the being together is sort of like being in a recording studio, and you're coming back each day with material, and you're showing it to each other.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Last year, we brought you a story about making imaging machines like CT scanners more child-friendly. The issue was that the devices were so intimidating to children that it was affecting the ability of the technicians to get good results. The solution was to incorporate the machines into imaginative scenes like a campground or a submarine to disguise them. But it turns out that it's not just children who are intimidated. Magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs, don't necessarily look scary to adult patients, but they do make a sound roughly like this. And that was causing problems for a significant number of patients. One leading MRI manufacturer, Waukesha-based GE Healthcare, has now developed basically a less noisy MRI machine, one that sounds like this. Richard Hausman is president and CEO of the Magnetic Resonance Division of GE Healthcare. Robert Weisbecker is administrative director of radiology for Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare, whose Elmbrook Hospital is one of the first in the country to adopt the new technology. They told Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in February what it was about an MRI machine that generates so much noise.
Well, actually, an MRI scanner is a diagnostic tool which allows you to look into the body. And it uses a lot of technology. And one of those technologies actually is introducing some kind of vibrations typically in the system. And vibrations, as we know from the loudspeaker, are generating noise. And this can be pretty loud, like a jackhammer actually. But we need that to kind of get the images acquired.
So the vibration is a necessary part of the process itself.
Correctly. It's a mandatory part of it. But it was always annoying, actually, to the patient. So we at GE Healthcare looked at a methodology to get rid of those noises.
Well, and so when the devices first came on the market, was the philosophy simply that there's nothing to be done, that noise was a necessary evil, a trade-off for what the machines were designed to accomplish?
Well, for a long time, actually, it was a necessary evil. It was thought to be a necessary evil, to be honest, until we at GE Healthcare actually kind of had the idea to completely avoid the noise from the source by switching the gradients, as we call them, in the system in a different form, but still having the same performance as on usual MRI scan.
You mentioned that people found the noise annoying at the very least. Let me ask, in a clinical setting, what was the upshot to that? Were patients shying away from having imaging done because they were intimidated by the process?
We at Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare have found that some of the patients, because of the noise, would shy away from the MR. Because even with the noise, one of the things that every patient who goes in the magnet, the first thing they do is put earplugs into them. So that raises their awareness of the noise level in the magnet to begin with. But particularly the patients who are coming from an MR from a headache, migraine standpoint, you know, introducing them into an environment that is a fairly loud on and off banging noise is counterproductive to getting a quality scan, because not only is it noisy, as it goes on and off, we at times see patients flinch, and when they move, we need to start the scan over again. So it also expands the time of the exam itself.
Well, and was that the primary way that you mitigated the noise, that you made it better? You gave people earplugs?
You gave them earplugs, you gave them headphones, you gave them music to listen to, you try to talk to them and give them a heads up on when the next noise level is coming so they can prepare for it. But historically, there wasn't a lot to do.
Well, so let's scan forward, if you will, to what you're now able to do. I mean, we talked about what makes a typical MR machine make so much noise, how do you go after the noise in developing the new generation? Is it different work that's being done to generate the same results?
Actually, in the last few years, many people thought about the noise levels in MRI, and a lot of solutions were developed by damping it down to a certain extent. In most cases, also kind of compromising performance. We actually choose a completely different way by radically changing the way the whole MRI scan is acquired. You need a high-fidelity system for that, and we have that at GE Healthcare. And actually, this is a technology which can be upgraded to existing systems, which is also good for our customers because it's an option which they can additionally acquire.
So a hospital such as Elmbrook doesn't need to necessarily go out and buy an entirely new piece of imaging equipment. They would just need this add-on to do this.
Correct.
Can you walk us through, I mean, obviously this is proprietary information, but to the degree that you can talk about it, what's different? What's happening in this quieter version of the MRI machines that doesn't happen in a typical machine?
Well, typically what you do in an MRI scan, you switch on and off very quickly additional small magnetic fields. And those magnetic fields are necessary to encode, so to say, the signal which you acquire so that you exactly know where the MRI signal comes from the body, so the individual voxel. If you don't do that appropriately, you don't have an image, so you have just a mess of signal. So this switching on and off is a normal way of doing it. We developed a completely new technology where we switch it way less on and off, but still use the full performance of these additional magnetic fields which we switch on. We need the fidelity of those signals so that they stay constant for a certain period of time, but they don't switch as fast anymore. And that actually just avoids the noise from the source.
The switching on and off was one of the key things that caused this really loud noise.
This generated the vibrations, and the vibrations generated the noise.
Did hospitals like Elmbrook request changes like this? I mean, was there a venue for feedback? Is that how GE finds that this is really something that patients want?
At Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare, we have, you know, conversations with GE on multiple accounts of what we're hearing from patient experiences, because when they've installed new equipment, they've come up and asked, what are you hearing from patients, good, bad? You know, how can we improve this piece of equipment? You know, and from an MR standpoint, the size of the bore was one that now is bigger than it was in the past. The weight limit on the machine was bigger than it was in the past. So kind of the third one left is kind of the noise that is the limiting factor for patients. And that was the next step that they solved. So when we were looking to buy a new magnet, we answered two of ours with the bigger bore and the higher weight limit for the patients. And the third one was the silent scan, which kind of made it an easy decision for us of where we were going from a vendor choice.
And I want to clarify, your work is with Wheaton Franciscan in its entirety. Elmbrook is the first of the hospitals to have this in place, right?
Correct.
And how long has it been in place?
It's been in place since the end of November. And since then, we've had, you know, patients obviously go through the MR. The ones who appreciate the lack of noise are the ones who have been there in the past and have come out of the scan room and asked, am I done? You know, where did the noise go? Wonder if we completed the scan. You know, they have many more questions, not understanding that the exam is done, than they would have in the past.
And this, to you, must be a good sense that you've done something right here.
Oh, yeah. We are pretty happy about the feedback and actually also the commercial feedback and success of this new silent scan technology from GE. And actually, we are the first one. Actually, it's very unique for us in GE. And I'm very happy to say also here in this radio station that this was developed here in the Milwaukee area. And we're also very happy that Wheaton Franciscan is actually the first in the Milwaukee area to have the silent scan installed.
Is this where, would you say, you know, realizing that you work specifically for GE, but would you imagine this is where the technology is going? Is this going to be a pretty common part of the MRI equation in the future?
We would think so, actually. There was the bore size, which was for a long time an issue, so we went to wider bore scanners. More patient comfort is the overall tendency. And the last thing actually was the noise. And so I think this is the way to go forward, and we're pioneering that.
What was the most challenging piece of the puzzle in getting this noise to almost essentially go away?
for the system itself, the most challenging part is the fidelity of the individual components of the system. To keep the currents, introducing this additional magnetic fields constant is key for this technology. It's not so much a fast switching, it's the more fidelity of the system, and that's the most challenging part of it.
Let me ask, to the degree that either of you can talk about this, how cost figures into the equation. Obviously, when MRIs first came on the market, these were very, very expensive machines. They are certainly more common than they used to be. But adding something to it, I would imagine, drives the cost up. Obviously, it's a concern for a hospital system. But how big a part of the picture is it for you?
Anytime we buy a new piece of equipment, there's always add-on products to it. And when we go through and evaluate, is it worth the additional dollars that it is? And when something comes along the line of a silent scan where it provides, you know, one of the things that we want to do at Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare is provide the best patient experience. If we can get that piece of equipment that will provide a better patient experience, also provide us access to some patients who in the past wouldn't have had an MR, I mean, the price point has to be fairly high for not to make sense for us to do it, and it didn't get to that degree. But in the past, there have been things that are out there that get to be cost prohibitive from the healthcare standpoint.
Well, right. It eventually touches the patients' lives too. I mean, I would imagine if you could devise, you know, there are people that think a flu shot hurts a lot, and you could devise a flu shot that doesn't hurt, but it costs $1,000, people probably would stay away from that flu shot.
Correct.
We at GE Healthcare actually are looking really for create productivity for our customers. I mean, if I recall back, I mean, MR is now around about 30 years old. Actually, last fall, we had a celebration of 30 years of high-field MRI. If I look back, I personally started in 88 doing MRI development. And at that time, the scanners were actually less performant, definitely less comfortable, but at least the same price, if not higher price. So we as GE Healthcare try to make it more performant, using new patient comfort technologies, but at a more aggressive price point. So that's basically how we try to get productivity into the system.
Are we at the point with imaging technology that we're now able to think more about patient comfort and less about getting the results?
I would say it's both. It's patient comfort and it's new applications. Think about all the degenerative disease issues like Alzheimer and Parkinson. MRI is a great non-invasive, non-radiative technology to find those little subtle things. We just do a nice, interesting cooperation with the NFL to find early signs of concussion for the football players or any kind of sports, actually, and even the army personnel. So those are things where we work hard on new applications as well.
Well, and let me ask this, because as you say, MRI is non-radiative. There was this op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about, a couple of doctors criticizing the overuse of CT scans and the dangers of unnecessary radiation. Do you see MRI playing a larger role? Obviously, there are differences in the applications of MRI versus CT, but is this one of the answers to that equation?
I would say also in CT, we at GE Healthcare, we are pushing a lot the low-dose aspects of CT as well. So this is actually going to the right direction, and there are real worlds about between the older technologies in CT and today's technology. So I would say CT is advancing also very much. Overall, we see from the MRI business globally and also in the United States actually more usage of MRI.
Rob Weisbecker, are you in Wheaton Franciscan sensitive to that issue of overuse of CT or other imaging?
Right. I mean, we monitor, you know, how much imaging we're using by physician at times. We want to make sure that we're doing the appropriate scan for the right reason at the right time, and continuing evaluating what our dose strategy is, and also balancing are they in the right modality when they're having an imaging test done. And that's something that you'll see over the next couple of years will continue to become more and more important as the technology gets better for reducing dose, and also the technology gets better for us to monitor patients' dose and provide them what dose they're getting for each exam that they get.
Where is MRI going beyond this? Imaging is better than it's been. The noises now can be less of a concern than it has been. What are the hurdles yet to clear in MR?
What we are doing at GE Healthcare is actually pushing the envelope. in spreading MRI as a technology globally much more than it was in the past. I mean, we have now under development solutions for emerging markets. We have solutions for very interesting solutions for newborns, for early borns, for solutions putting the MRI into the NICU itself so that you don't have to transport the babies in the hospital. So what we want to create is reach for MRI as a technology globally as well as to new patient groups.
Well, very good. Richard Hausman and Rob Weisbecker, thank you both so much. Much appreciated.
Thank you for the time.
Thanks for the time. You're welcome.
Richard Hausman is president and CEO of the Magnetic Resonance Division of GE Healthcare. Robert Weisbecker is administrative director of radiology for Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare. They first spoke with Mitch Teich in February, and there's a link to more about GE's silent scan technology from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Making MRIs more comfortable for patients is a laudable goal, but getting them comfortable with newly minted doctors can be more difficult, as contributor Bruce Campbell discovered.
We are in the last steps of getting surgery arranged. The counseling is complete and the consent is on the clipboard. Just as the patient is putting pen to paper, she asks me, "When I'm asleep, you're not going to let some trainee practice on me, are you? I mean, I wouldn't let the brand new stylist cut my hair, right? I don't want any residents involved in my case." The patient sets her pen down and eyes me carefully. These can be uncomfortable conversations. I think back on the times when my own family members have needed surgery. We all want the very best for our loved ones. I begin. "The operation requires two people to perform. I am right there for every part of the surgery. The resident does nothing without my direct involvement." These statements are true, but she is not satisfied. "Not good enough," she says. "How will I know for certain? I insist that there be no students or residents in the operating room at all." At this point, I need to decide if the proposed operation is one I can do by myself. If so, I might still proceed. The patient has put me in a box, but she has the perfect right to make such a demand. So I start again. "I can't know for certain," I say, "but changing my usual routine for a complex procedure like yours might place you at some unnecessary risk." She looks at me skeptically. "In any case," I add, "recent research has confirmed that having residents participate in surgery is indeed safe." And then I tell her about a recent study of 60,000 major operations performed between 2005 and 2007. The study determined that cases involving residents did take longer and had a superficial wound infection rate of 3% as opposed to 2%. But there were no differences in postoperative deaths or serious complications, and the resident group even had slightly fewer postoperative strokes. One of the things I love most about my career is that I have had the opportunity to teach head and neck surgery to the next generation of young physicians. I love seeing that spark of recognition when one of them discovers and hones a skill that he or she never knew they possessed. I enjoy watching them connect theory to technique with real-world approaches. My patient thinks for a moment and then signs the surgical consent form. Her eyes narrow a bit. "Watch them like a hawk." "Absolutely," I assure her. Ralph Waldo Emerson once noted that the skill to do comes from doing. I like that. The skill to do comes from doing. Knowing that the system safely trains young surgeons is comforting. Someday in the not-too-distant future, I will probably need surgery myself. It is great to know that the students and residents training today will be ready to safely help me when that day arrives.
Lake Effect SES Dr. Bruce Campbell is a head and neck cancer surgeon at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He also blogs at Reflections in a Head Mirror. He read his essay, "No Residents." There won't be any MRIs or residents on the Riverside stage this Saturday evening, but there will be two dancers and one public radio show host, Ira Glass. We'll chat with him ahead of his upcoming Milwaukee performance when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. When Ira Glass first came on the national airwaves with This American Life in 1996, there was nothing quite like it on the public end of the radio dial. Intimate, quirky, funny, poignant, and not your typical radio. The show told very personal stories in a cinematic way. Over the years, This American Life has broadened its horizons, even venturing into a TV series for a couple of seasons, but at its heart, it remains all about telling good stories in its own inimitable way. Well, it makes sense then that the next iteration of the show would combine, as Glass himself puts it, two things that normally would have no business being together: modern dance and radio. On stage, telling stories. Three acts, two dancers, one radio host comes to the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee this Saturday evening. We caught up with Ira Glass in New York to find out more, and he joins us now. Ira, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to have you on the show.
Very nice to be here again.
We're looking forward to having you and Monica and Anna here in Milwaukee with three acts, two dancers, and one radio host. And I guess I have to start at the beginning. How did this collaboration begin? Whose idea was this? Were you drinking?
There was no drinking. I wish we had the excuse of drinking. The whole thing would make more sense if they were drinking. But I saw them perform, and I thought there was something in the sensibility of what they did that seemed exactly like the sensibility of the radio show that I work on, except they don't use any words. And I thought it would be interesting to see if we could figure out a way to work together. And so we tried a couple of different things. And then at some point, Monica suggested that we do a full-length show where I would tell stories and they would dance, and that we would try to integrate in these two art forms that nobody really wanted integrated at all, which is a modern dance on the one hand and radio stories on the other.
And yet somehow it works. And it seems that I haven't seen it yet. I've only seen the video that you have on your website. But what seems to happen is that you're both still telling stories, and that seems to be the common point.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something about the sensibility of their work where I think in their dances, they're documenting small everyday moments. And then also they're entertainers. They're out for fun. They're really funny. They're really fun to watch. It isn't the kind of modern dance where you feel like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to get this. It's the kind of modern dance where you totally get it. It's really out for fun.
When you started putting the show together and when Monica suggested doing it as a full evening of a show, did you start with the stories from This American Life, or did you start with brand new stories to all three of you?
We started by looking at old stories from This American Life, actually, and then at some point we added to those. But the stories from This American Life that we looked at any story that involved dancers. And then at some point we thought to ourselves, like, well, what could you dance about that you could also make a radio story about? And we thought, okay, love stories. And then we thought stories about loss or death or things like that are appropriate subjects for a dance. And then so we sort of ran at those. And then the other thing that I did is that I interviewed Monica and Anna about their experiences as dancers. And then some of the pieces are about that.
So do they dance their own stories?
At one point they do, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. I love the idea of mixing these two media that don't really seem to have anything in common other than that you're telling stories. But, you know, taking that oral and taking the visual and the kinetic and just mixing it all up and having a good time with it, which it seems like you're doing from what I've seen.
Yeah, it's a very fun show. Like, it's a weirdly satisfying show to perform in. I've been to Milwaukee before, you know, giving talks. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been to the Pabst Theater before giving talks. And this is so different because it's an entire show with, you know, lighting cues and props and costume changes and things like that. And it's a very funny show. It's a very emotional show. And it's just like, it's like being in a real play or something for me, like in a way that's very different than putting on a radio show normally is.
Is that something that you'd had experience with before?
No. Oh, my God, no.
Oh,
no.
So this is your debut as an actor in a way.
Pretty much this is my first time as an actor since, like, you know, my high school production of South Pacific. Yeah.
Right.
What has that done for you in terms of your own storytelling? What has it taught you?
I mean, honestly, it's so different from making the radio show. Nothing's happened in it that's shed any light for me on how to make the radio show or how to tell stories or anything like that. I feel like what we're doing is so like a genre to itself that it kind of has to live there on its own. If anything, the thing that I've gotten out of it is it's a very different kind of performance to do because I have to go out there and actually, for most of the, there are parts of the show where I can ad lib a little bit, but for so much of the show, like I really do have to like be a professional like narrator and performer and hit my marks and, you know, say things at the right speed and, you know, and I hit all these kinds of music cues where if I talk faster or slower, it messes up where the dancers have to be at a certain spot. So I've had to train myself to speak at a certain speed in certain pieces because otherwise it becomes impossible to dance to, which is a really weird thing to have had to have learned.
And what about them? Have they said to you that it's changed the way they've approached dance?
I think it hasn't changed anything for them, no.
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 They're just saying, please, Ira, hit your mark, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Do your job.
I do understand, though, that the important thing is that there are sparklers.
There's sparklers? there aren't sparklers, but there are confetti cannons and things exploding for sure.
Okay.
There are sparkly things.
Sparkly things, okay.
Yeah.
And batons too. I think I heard somebody say batons that there
batons,
are.
Batons, definitely batons. Yeah. Yeah. Batons. There's a lot of batons.
You did this at Carnegie Hall. It went over really well. How are audiences reacting to it outside of New York?
That is one thing about the whole process that's been weird. Is that the very first time we performed any of it was at Carnegie Hall.
So you got there first, yeah.
That was our debut. And since then, we just traveled to smaller and lesser-known theaters. And how has it worked outside New York? It's worked great. I mean, everywhere we've taken it. Like we once a month, we go to a different city. And everywhere we go, it's killed. It's killed. And I think partly what's going on is that I think the audience really has no idea what they're in for when they buy the tickets. Like they buy the tickets as a real act of faith of like, well, I guess this will be okay, I guess. And then when it turns out to be really good, I think they're very excited that they didn't waste their money.
Does it help to be a fan of the show? I mean, will people who like the radio show get something like that when they come see you?
Yes, I think it feels exactly like the radio show at its best. Like this, it's stories and very satisfying ones and funny ones. So in that way, it's just like the radio show. And a lot of the stories either have been on the radio show or could be on the radio show. And so in that way, it's just like the radio show, except, you know, plus dancers. So if anybody has listened to the radio show and thought, like, I really love that show, if that guy would just get some dancers, then, you know.
Yeah, dancers finally. And a confetti cannon. Yeah. You really can't go wrong with that.
No.
So, okay, every month you take it out. Has it changed? Have you changed stories? Do you think about where you're going or is it pretty much fixed?
We changed it a lot in the first 3 or 4 months, and then recently it's been fixed. Though I think we're probably going to go through a series of changes at some point soon. Probably not before Milwaukee, but possibly after. I bet it'll start to evolve again. Just because I'm not. I feel more comfortable as like performing it if it's a little bit different. And so I bet we'll keep nudging it this way and that.
So it sounds like that this has a long life ahead of it. You're not thinking of stopping this anytime soon.
No. In fact, we have it booked through like 2015. And then we're trying to figure out how to bring it to New York. And in fact, we're in negotiations with some producers to see if there's a way to put it up on Broadway for a few weeks.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, that'd be really fun. Like it's unclear if the economics of that can work, but that would be a really fun way for the whole thing to end up.
So do you think that this is a trend for, you know, everyone talks about how we live in a, you know, this multimedia age where there's so many different ways to access information and stories. You've taken the basic idea of storytelling and kind of put it like back on stage, which is kind of old fashioned.
Yes. I really wish I could make the argument that this is a trend and that this is where everything is going. I really wish I could make that case that soon Wolf Blitzer will be touring with the Rockettes and Anderson Cooper we'll be touring with Alvin Ailey. I really – that is really what I hope to – that's what I'm here to make the case for, like effect.
I
that's
love
exactly
it.
Right. If those guys are gonna, it's gonna be playing catch up. I can just feel it. I can just mm-hmm. feel that that's where we're heading for sure. I think if you're a journalist without your own dance team, you're so 20th century.
Exactly. You're just behind the curve. Behind the curve.
You're behind the curve. Yeah. It is interesting working with dancers, like because I feel like because public radio itself is kind of like a subgenre, you know what I mean? It's not the biggest part of the media at all. And then dance is even smaller. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm teaming up with an art form that's even less popular than public radio. So
it's like the two people at the school dance, you know, way off in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you decided to get together.
I'm going with poetry next. The next tour is going to be me and some poets
dancing.
I hope so.
Yeah. You can't leave the dancers out now. You've included them.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I think that anyone who comes to see the show will see that we started to make the show because we thought it would be a fun show for audiences, and I feel like that very much. You can feel that in the show. You can feel us out for our own amusement and the audiences, for sure.
Well, I for one, am very much looking forward to seeing how it all comes together and to hearing the stories. I mean, because like we've said, it's three acts, and you start with what it's like to be in show business, and then you move—
And to dance, mostly. To dance. What it's like to dance.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. then what it's like to fall and stay in love, and then what it's like to lose love. So it kind of encompasses some very— the whole of human experience. I mean, movement and love. I mean, you really can't get much more elemental.
Yeah. It's grand, actually, in that way. And I feel like, you know, when you're talking about, you know, trying to work with dancers, I mean, really, you have to find material that's really emotional, right? Like, because dance is so very, very emotional. And so that really dictated a lot of the stories.
Do you have a favorite?
I have a couple favorites, yeah. Like, but one of my favorites is one of the dancers, Anna. When I interviewed her in the studio, one of the things I had her talk about is what's going through her head when she's on stage with Monica, her collaborator. What is she thinking? And it's really funny what she's thinking. And basically, that's what she's talking about as you see the two of them do a duet. That's a very lovely. Bit of the show.
Is she worrying about hitting her marks as well?
No, she's worried about apparently she and Monica are very, very competitive when they're on stage together, trying to outshine the other.
Interesting.
And that she notices Monica doing things to steal focus away from her, Anna. And so she just writes about what that's like. To have her friend and collaborator, you know, on stage where they're just totally trying to scene hog the scene away from her, and how she reacts and what she does and what she thinks and what they say to each other when they come off stage, and so she kind of lays all of that out. It's so fun to hear because when they're dancing, it just seems like so very polite and professional and all, and then to hear what's actually going on is very funny.
Yes. Yeah, it's kind of pulling the wool back, you know, pulling that curtain back and seeing what's going on behind.
But, yeah.
Well, like I said, I'm really looking forward to seeing how this all comes together. We're looking forward to having you again in Milwaukee and in a different guise, telling stories in a different way. And Ira, it is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Ira Glass is the host and producer of Public Radio's This American Life. He, along with dancers Monica Bill Barnes and Anna Bass, will be on stage at the Riverside Theater this Saturday evening in a stage show called Three Acts, Two Dancers, One Radio Host. There is a link to more information, including how to get tickets, from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, the Wisconsin edition of the Postcards from America Photographic Project is winding up here in Milwaukee this month. We'll revisit an interview with the second group of photographers when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. For the past year and a half, a group of photographers from the photographic cooperative Magnum Photos has fanned out across America. The project, called Postcards from America, aims to capture the essence of specific places across the country from multiple points of view. The fifth and latest subject of the project is Wisconsin. Photographers began arriving in August of last year. Some were here in February, and the last group is here now. An exhibition based on the work of those 11 photographers will be on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum this summer. In the meantime, you can see some of the photos on the project's Tumblr page as they're taken. Donovan Wiley and Jakob Sobel, two of the photographers who were working in Wisconsin in February, joined me in the studio then, along with Milwaukee Art Museum photography curator Lisa Sutcliffe, who explained how the project happened to come to Milwaukee.
It was a perfect storm. I actually, when I was moving here, sent out an email saying, I'll be moving to be the curator of photography at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Martin Parr was on that list, and he wrote me right back saying, I'm going to be in Milwaukee. Let's get together. And I had known about Postcards from America since the inception. I've always followed the project. So when Martin came, I said to him, wouldn't you like to come here next? And they'd been looking for a city in the Midwest, and I want to let the photographers talk a little bit about why, but it just seemed like the perfect opportunity to commission a group of photographers to come here and provide us with 11 different perspectives on what our community looks like.
All right, so let's have Donovan and Jakob talk a little bit about, because you've been involved in this project from the beginning, both of you, is that true?
No, okay. I'm new in the project. I was not in it from the beginning, but I followed the work from the other photographers and very happy to be in it now.
So is this the first?
This is my first trip with this project, yeah.
Okay. And Donovan?
I've done three, Rochester, Florida, and now Milwaukee. You know, Postcards is it's an interesting idea, you know, insofar as it's really about the photographer taking control, taking the initiative, if you like, within the contemporary industry, you know, where there's so many changes happening within photography and the industry. And this is about really the photographers coming together and working together in a way that can be stimulating to each other. You know, we're all making independent work, but we are kind of all, it's a bit like a band in a kind of funny way. And the being together is sort of like being in a recording studio and you're coming back each day with material and you're showing it to each other and you're getting feedback. And it's a fantastic process. It's a fantastic experience to work with colleagues like this.
And it's that collaboration that I find interesting. And I like the band analogy very much because normally photographers, you're working on your own. And it's your vision that you're trying to capture on film or digital media. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to present that to the world. But this is different. And how is that for you working differently? I mean, is this something you've done before, this kind of collaboration?
I have never tried it before. I always worked on my own for the last 10 years. Also, I always traveled alone, never with assistants and so on. So to me, it's completely new. But as I just arrived the other day, it's also, well, today is kind of going to be the first day where I'm going to edit my material from the, I did some shooting in Milwaukee in the streets yesterday and went to visit this center for old people's home. So today I'm going to edit and hopefully make the first post tonight from this work.
And how has the getting feedback from other photographers been for you?
Well, that's what's going to happen today.
Oh, so it hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet because I arrived just the other day.
Right.
But today I'm going to do the first edit of my shooting yesterday. So.
Well, what's interesting is that we all have independent, I suppose you could say, styles. Well, I don't like to use that word. It's how they interweave with each other that makes it rich. And we all bring something of our own practice, you know, to the project. And in that sense, it's kind of like a visual tapestry, if you know what I mean.
I also find it interesting the idea that you have this very individual idea of, you know, what you'll shoot, what interests you, what kind of images you want to make public. But then you're also creating something together that's bigger than each individual person.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think the challenge, well, certainly for me, because I'm not American, you know, there's a responsibility to do something that's useful. to the places that you're in. And certainly from growing up in Northern Ireland, we were always nervous about how outsiders represented my home. So I think when I did the first postcard, which was Rochester, the city of Rochester, there was a real challenge to find a way of photographing that kind of was dictated by the city. And not dictated by the city, but sort of controlled or funneled by the city, and it, where it would come to me. And I found a strategy to do that. And I think, we all each have that challenge where we apply our practice, with the respect to the place.
Are you coming into it, both of you, with an idea of what you want to show, or are you hoping to just stay open and have it tell you? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. I found a strategy which kind of sounds crazy, but it works, where it really began in Rochester, where I saw a picture. I saw a building that looked interesting, and I wanted to take a photograph of it. And I realized pretty quickly I needed to get some height to shoot it properly. And I managed to get to the roof of a building opposite, and it didn't work as a picture. But what did happen was that I got this extraordinary perspective on the city, from the roof. And that really became a way of looking at the city. I think I did every roof in downtown Rochester, and indeed every car park. And it's a fantastic feeling. It's like you walk into a building or a multi-story car park, and you don't know what you're going to get. And it's fun, And you get to the top, and you go, "Wow, that's extraordinary." And if you do it all over the city, you do create this kind of survey, and patterns emerge. And then when you leave the city, you've sort of created this archive, which is useful, yeah?
Yeah, and it's a way for people who live here to see themselves differently.
Indeed, because as you know, when you live in your own city, you don't really look at it in a concentrated way.
No, and I think that's true for all of us.
Of course, yeah.
You just get used to it, and it's
absolutely
common, and so you don't think about it.
That's right.
And you're not from here, so you're coming to a place that is foreign. And interesting and new in the way foreign places are for all of us. And Jakob, I know you're just starting this, but for you so far, after one day of shooting, are there patterns and things that interest you here in Milwaukee that surprise you?
Well, first, I think I look for connections. I mean, I look for having this close encounter with other people. That is my approach within photography. Like I kind of use these small pocket cameras, and I use it as a kind of a tool to get close to other people, to connect with them and to communicate with them. So that is my kind of mission in Milwaukee as well, to get to know the city through the people in these close encounters. And also I'm very fascinated by actually the cold weather and the darkness. I often traveled places that were cold and dark, and I tend to look for warm things in these cold places and make this contrast or combination between the cold and the warmth of the people. So that's what I'm hoping to find here as well.
The cold and the dark. It's near and dear to our hearts right about now, for sure. Lisa, how is all of this going to be presented at the museum? Because I know there's another group of photographers that's coming later in the spring.
Correct. There's 5 more photographers coming in the first 2 weeks of April. So the way we've structured it is that there would be 3 different groups coming to town. The first group came in August, and they were centered around the idea of the state fair and the festivals that take place outside and in the wonderful warm weather. This group is obviously here in the deep, dark winter. So looking at our architecture and meeting some of the people, going out to some of the smaller towns. The third group, their plans have yet to take shape, but I can't wait to see what they do. There'll be 5 photographers joining us then. And we've done an artist panel with each group that comes to town so that the community can get a sense of what they've discovered, things that they've noticed, also get a sense of who they are as artists and what perspective they're bringing to the city. So there will be a panel on April 6th at the museum. And then this summer we're going to do an exhibition where all of the photographs that have been made will be sifted and will come together. So if you want to come into the Milwaukee Art Museum this summer and see what they've seen, I think it'll be really exciting.
And will that exhibition then travel or go online to be an archive as part of this Postcards from America project?
There's actually already an online archive.
Okay.
The photographers post their pictures to the Postcards from America Tumblr, which you can also see on the Milwaukee Art Museum Photography Council Facebook page. And so you can sort of see what they're making as they're going. And, you know, eventually, as all of these trips are completed, you know, there'll be 5 or 6 trips, there will be a larger exhibition that will travel the country with all of these pictures.
Now, for the two of you, how is being part of it? And I know, Jakob, you're still so new with this, so this might not be a good question for you. But for Donovan, how has participating in this affected your practice in other ways, in, you know, the other kinds of projects that you're undertaking?
Yeah, that is a good question, because I think all of us on Postcards don't go into the, you know, into the project like it's an assignment. You know, we go into the project really being ourselves and bringing our own practice fully to the table. And that has consequences for sure. And I think for me, it has made me think a lot about America and draw parallels to the practice I've been using over the past decade or so, and maybe want to work here in a more long-term way. And I think the ultimate way that it's affected my practice is that it's broadened it. You know, it's really broadened it in a way which I wouldn't have expected. It's so hard when you make work, because you have to change and you have to grow and you have to evolve, and getting the feedback of colleagues is fantastic, and you end up doing things that you never expected you would do, you know, and you find ideas, you find ways of articulating ideas faster. So it for me, it's I would say quite sincerely, it broadened my practice and hopefully made it richer.
And Jakob, I know, again, you're at the beginning of this process, but do you anticipate a similar kind of thing happening for your practice as you participate in Postcards?
Well, I'm hoping that will be the result, that I will get inspired somehow to for my work in the future as well. But as you said, I mean, I just arrived the other day, and today I'm going to start the editing, and hopefully we will talk about the work and so on. It would be great for me in the future as a part of Magnum Photos as well to do this kind of project. So hopefully this is the beginning of something bigger as well.
I was going to say the other thing that I would think would be great is the connection, the personal connection and artistic connection that you guys all make to each other that you might not have had without this project.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, we are at a stage in photography where we need to talk more about it. I mean, when I say we are at a stage of photography, I actually mean that photography is at a stage where it needs to be discussed and interrogated, given the nature of the changes with digital technology and with distribution and so many things. And we on Postcards are really, I mean, we don't have a high opinion of the photographer, but we have a very high opinion of photography. We really wrestle with that together. We're not complacent about the medium. We're frightened of it. We stand in awe of it. And we try to make the best work possible.
Well, I think it's going to be fantastic. And I welcome you both to Milwaukee. This is just great that you're here. And I cannot wait to see how you see our city. Mm. And this is going to be great. And also, this is Alessandra, right?
Alessandra Sanguinetti is joining us this afternoon. And she'll be traveling out to the sort of western part of the state to look at some of the smaller towns out there.
Okay. So it's not just Milwaukee.
It's going to be the greater Wisconsin state.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific. Well, thank you, all three of you, for coming in today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Sutcliffe is the curator of photography at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Donovan Wiley of Northern Ireland and Jakob Sobel of Denmark are two of the 11 photographers who captured images from Wisconsin as part of the Postcards from America project. We spoke to them in February, and the final group of photographers is here now. The complete exhibit will open here this summer, but in the meantime, there's a link to the project's Tumblr page at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Well, they're not exactly postcards, but our weekly series, The Islands of Milwaukee, hopes to hear from you.
Welcome to The Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie with The Islands of Milwaukee. We've got a question. Would you like to hear it?
This week's question is, what would you like to tell Milwaukee?
Oh, boy. How long have you got?
A lot of folks came back with direct requests for their local government and fellow citizens.
I'd like to tell Milwaukee that we need more jobs.
And fix the roads.
Yeah. Oh. More programs and that for the handicapped. Need to get behind that.
We also had a lovely batch of responses from local history lovers.
I would like to tell Milwaukee that Milwaukee is a great city with a rich history, and we should learn about that history and try to continue the rich history into the present time.
And this woman, who wanted to tell Milwaukee about her appreciation for the Goodwill Meals on Wheels program.
The program that I'm in now has helped me immensely. I'm not hungry anymore. I have my food in the afternoon, but it can also, I have enough to save for supper, so I have lunch and supper, so it means a lot to me.
What would you like to tell Milwaukee? Call our Islands line, visit our website. We want to incorporate your answers into our exhibit at City Hall later this year. If you're a proud Milwaukeean, or if you have a bone to pick, or if you just want to give a shout out to the Brewers, we want to hear it. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.